Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. What I love about Shopify is basically how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. I know we use Shopify here at Betches, and honestly, anyone with any kind of business could really benefit from Shopify. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/betches, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/betches now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/betches.
Welcome back to Not Another True Crime Podcast. I'm Sarah Levine. Guys, we have lost Danny, not in an ominous way. We lost him to the whims of the New Jersey path, but it kind of worked out because he was here anyway, but now he's just in Danny's place. We have comedian Josh Gondelman. So excited to bring you on to the
show. Thank you so much for having me. Losing him to the New Jersey path sounds like a euphemism for he joined the mob.
Oh my God. Which is very fitting for what we're going to talk about today. But first up, just so you guys know, Josh is an amazing comedian. He writes the That's Marvelous newsletter, which is so funny every week. I'm reading it and DMing him like, thank you for talking about this
brave.
And he also has a stand-up special that you can watch on YouTube called People Pleaser.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm so psyched to be here.
Yes, I'm very excited because we're going to talk about this museum heist that I always see Josh tweeting about.
Yeah.
Like always.
I'm obsessed with a 34-year-old museum heist because I'm extremely on the pulse of the culture.
It's the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist, and that name is too long, honestly.
But you can't change it.
You can't. And this is sort of like local to you, right? This issue.
So I grew up in the Boston suburbs. And we went on a field trip to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. And it's this beautiful museum in like a beautiful estate in Boston, in the city. And there it's like this gorgeous house. And the art was arranged by this like wealthy art collecting woman who's like other politics I certainly can't vouch for, as she was like a white lady who died in 1924. But she had this beautiful museum and the art in it is arranged all to her specifications. So she didn't curate it like a standard museum curation where there's like, oh, these are from this period, or like these, we have a thematic unity here that we want to talk about. She was just like, I like the way it looks when these paintings are together or these sculptures. And so she curated this museum, left it as an endowment with the stipulation that nothing can be changed. It all has, so there's no like rotating collection. It's all just like, here's the way my house looked when I died, and this is how it'll stay forever.
Yes, you can't add or change anything. So yeah. The museum is just the museum.
Well, with a notable change that happened in 1990, which is that on the night of St. Patrick's Day, 1990, two thieves came in and stole, I believe, 13 pieces of art.
Yes.
Which have not been returned. And the effect on the museum is that there are picture frames with paintings cut out and that were like razor cut out of the frame. And then there are also like things that are just missing, like physical objects, a Chinese goo, I believe it's called. And so when you go through, it's like a pretty thrilling field trip because you see all this beautiful art, and then you see like these empty frames, they go, oh, that got stolen and we're not allowed to replace it. And it is like an extremely local thing. It's also like an extremely Boston thing to be like, nah, you can't change it, that's how Isabella left it. It's like, so it's like a really, it feels really like a real hometown crime. And I like it because when you asked me to talk about it, I was so excited because it's the rare true crime where there are no casualties as far as we know. And the violence done was two security guards were duct taped. They were handcuffed to a heating pipe and a workbench, and their heads were duct taped for the duration of the robbery. And knowing that there were 20 something guys in Boston in 1990, I have to believe they never sought a moment of therapy for it. They were just like, "Yeah, that happened, dude. Yeah. It was fucked up, kid."
Oh my god! Yeah.
So I'm obsessed with this, and I will also say I'm not like a scholar. There is an incredible. There's a pretty good documentary on Netflix.
Yes, Netflix.
It's pretty good. There's a great podcast called Last Seen, S-E-E-N, that WBUR, I believe, like it was a Boston Public Radio. Mm-hmm. Production, and it's amazing. There's like all these interviews with people that just sound like they swam out of the Charles River and are like, "What do you want to talk about me about the yacht theft? Yeah, dude, let's go."
Oh my god,
and
I'm obsessed.
It's awesome.
I'm obsessed. Okay, well, you guys, Josh probably knows more about this heist than me, but that's okay. I'm just gonna do a few bullet points and history, and feel free to chime in with your
please.
Thoughts whenever. So first of all, I was kind of interested in this woman's backstory, Isabella Stewart Gardner. So she was born in New York City in 1840, which always like blows my mind. I'm like, people were born back then?
Yeah, right. You just think like they happened.
Yeah. So she was born to a wealthy family. Her dad made his fortune importing Irish linen and like investments. And so when she was abroad at a finishing school, a classmate introduced her to her brother, John Jack Lowell Garden Jr. And I just feel if your name is John, how is Jack a better nickname? Like, I don't know what that's
about. It's right there, right? Yeah. You can just go John. When I worked with someone years ago who she and her husband named their son Jack because they were like,
"Yeah,
we don't want to, why are we going to name him a thing and then call him another thing his whole life?"
Yeah, like the James to Jim pipeline also always confuses me. I'm like, you're not saving anyone anytime.
No, and it's not like Jim is like a casual thing to say and James is formal. You know what I mean? It's not like, Jim, you're like, we actually don't say that in polite company. You can't say Jim.
Oh my God, exactly. Okay, so they got married in New York City in 1860, moved to Boston, shouts out. So starting in 1878, she joined a like society called the Dante Society, which sounds very mysterious, but
very Donatart, secret history type. Yeah.
So she started collecting rare books and manuscripts, and then in 1886 started getting into art collecting. And honestly, the details are kind of boring. This is an art history podcast. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, if you came here for art history, get out.
Yeah. In 1898, Jack died suddenly of a stroke. So they had actually had plans to buy a plot of land and build a museum. So she just continued that plan. And lo and behold, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum was born. It was finished in 1901. It didn't open to the public until 1903. And like you said, she died in 1924, and there's this endowment in her will to keep the museum open, but there's a stipulation that nothing can be added or removed from the collection. There was not, the robbery was a loophole from that endowment.
I think you could call it a loophole, right? You can't change anything. That would be pretty amazing, though, if it was just a curator that was like, "I hate this Vermeer," and then came up with the robbery just to get it out of the museum.
That would be so smart. So the robbery, in the early hours of March 18th, 1990, which you said was St. Patrick's Day, it's about one in the morning, two thieves dressed as policemen walked into the museum. How? Well, it was an open secret that the security kind of left much to be desired. They had two security guards. There were these, it was a 23-year-old and a 25-year-old guy, and the thieves basically tricked them into budging them in because they pretended to be the cops responding to a disturbance call about the nearby St. Patrick's Day celebrations.
And back in 1990 when someone buzzed and was like, yeah, let me in with the cops. You just like had no information. This was not only so all my information about this is coming from the podcast, the documentary. And then I did a Wikipedia review this morning before I came in. But like the only way to contact the real authorities was a button under the desk at the front. And so they were like, oh, come out. Let me see your ID. Right. And he was like, okay, fake cops. And then they just were like, gotcha. Because you just like couldn't, there was no way to verify information back then. You're just
they
like,
didn't
I don't
have
know.
A ring light.
Yeah, yeah. He's got the blue hat. Like that's cop, says cop to me.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I feel like they didn't get the memo. Like when you live in a New York City apartment of like never open the door if some stranger is buzzing.
Yeah. Totally. Right, right, right. You're like, you don't have to let him in. Yeah. But it's like, it's Boston. It's St. Patrick's Day.
Yes.
That's like, it's essentially the purge.
The purge. So, yeah. I mean, in true purge fashion, once inside, they duct taped the security guards to a pipe and a bench in the basement. This is my favorite part because they announced, and I can't do a Boston accent, so I'm sorry for you all.
No, this is good. I'm excited to hear what comes next.
They announced, gentlemen, this is a robbery.
God. That rules.
Right? Which is like, they were probably like, yeah, I think we got it, but thanks.
And that's like pre-Pulp Fiction, which I feel like is the greatest robbery announcement, right? Yeah. When they like stand up on the tables of the diner.
And yes. Like,
this is a robbery. It's great. Immortalized in, what's that song? It's Scooby Snacks by Dirty Rotten Criminals. Is that the name? It was like
that is a good name.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, actually. Both two good names.
I think I'm enough years older than you that this like weird one-hit wonder from the mid-90s might not have penetrated. Anyway, a fun-loving criminals. That's what they were called. Yeah.
I love a fun-loving criminal. That's kind of what we're about at this podcast.
This is what we're talking about. But yes. Yeah. So they announced it, which I think, again, genteel. The one thing from that is so funny from the last scene podcast that they stressed is, and I'd never thought about this, right? You think about art thieves as like Pierce Brosnan, Thomas Crown Affair. Like it's basically James Bond stealing art. But that's not usually who it is. It's usually just like the folks that would be stealing anything else decide to steal art.
You're like, I want to pivot in my career. I'm going to make a break into art.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So it's not like, you don't have to go to art school. You go to stealing school. And then art is a subset of things you can steal.
That is so interesting because I would not, I mean, first of all, I would not know where to move anything if I stole something. But I feel like art, it's a specific thing. You can't just roll up to a pawn shop with art.
Yeah.
You got to know people.
Right. With a Monet.
Yeah.
And just, they'll be like, we'll give you $50 for it.
But you also can't go to like Sotheby's because they'd be like, you've stolen this.
Right.
Because
they know when you're stealing from a museum, it's extremely traceable because either you go, oh, that's the real thing. And they go, well, that's from a museum, or it's a fake.
Yes. Okay. It's got to be tough. So I guess I have to respect art heist. I don't know what the noun version of that is. Art thieves. There we go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are just as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They're milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
So they disabled the cameras, then they smashed the protective glass on two Rembrandts and just cut the canvases out of the frames, which at first was interesting because I was like, how did they like, you're carrying these bulky things. I was like, how did they do that?
No, they just cut them out.
Smart thing.
Which
makes
is
sense.
Not standard. There's an innovation.
Yeah.
but they just whoosh, 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 with a razor. And so the, you know, you probably devalued the painting somewhat.
Yes. But otherwise, I was like, there's no way they're walking out with like 13 of these giant frames. Like,
yeah, like comical, like,
So they ended up making away with 13 paintings that today are valued at about $500 million. This I thought was very funny because they had to make two separate trips to their car.
Like groceries.
Exactly. Like you couldn't do it all in one. So they're like, all right, fuck, we just got to go back.
Trying to hold everything under their arms, dropping shit. Like, oh no, Rembrandt, oh no.
Exactly. And all in all, the whole heist took 80 minutes, I think.
And they were all over the museum. Because the museum, I think one of the interesting facets of this mystery is that the art, there was no evident pattern in what they took. It came from all different rooms of the museum. It's items of all different value. Some of there were more valuable pieces of art that were not taken.
Yes.
And so this is like, they still manage between these 13 sculptures, artifacts, paintings to get hundreds of millions of dollars worth of art. But it wasn't necessarily haphazard, but it wasn't what you would expect if you were like, we're going to go to this museum, we're going to steal 13 things. So they didn't get them all from one room, which would be logistically easier.
Yeah.
And they didn't target the highest value items.
Yes, it was definitely a weird kind of smorgasbord.
Yeah, which means it's kind of like a heist in the spirit of Isabella Stewart Gardner herself, right?
I'm just
like,
I like this, I like that.
Like, put them all together. Yeah.
I love that. She's probably in the grave, like, respect.
Yeah. Game recognize game.
Exactly. And so the guards actually weren't discovered until about 8 o'clock the next morning when the next shift came in. And like you said, they stole some of the most valuable paintings, but they left behind some of the most valuable ones too. And there were like some bronze figurines. One of the things they tried to steal was they tried to take Napoleon's Imperial Guard from its frame, but I guess they just weren't able to. So that was, I think, one of the reasons they weren't able to take one thing.
Yeah.
But so basically investigators couldn't really figure out what the motive was for the robbery, like, other than money, presumably. But they were like, did they choose these because they liked them the most for the ransom, just to be able, you know, just for the clout, to barter? Like, they didn't
really
know.
Yeah, a big theory that was prominent at the time was that it was like a crime committed so that the spoils could be returned in exchange for something else, right? But a prominent theory was like in exchange for the release of like mob members being held in prison or something.
Yes, and that is actually, that comes up a couple of times. So as far as whodunit, we still don't know. The case is cold because there are like no clues.
There is, though, on the museum's official website.
Oh, really?
They still offer a reward.
Yes. Okay. So they do have a $10 million reward still. And they also have an email you could just literally email if you have tips. It's reward@gardnermuseum.org.
If any listeners have tips for the return of this
artwork.
Imagine
I crack this open.
That would be so cool. But yeah, it's not just like the FBI has a reward. It's like the museum. It's part of museum lore, which I think makes it there's just like a localness to that I think is so charming.
Yes. I feel like we need a Nicolas Cage movie about this.
Yes. Yeah. Where he has to, instead of stealing the Declaration of Independence, right, has to recover this art.
I also noted that in one of the articles that the statute of limitations has expired a long time ago. So I just feel like, hey, if it was you, just say something. We won't be mad. You won't get in trouble.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, we'll just be impressed.
Yes.
More than anything. It's so much art. None of it has been recovered. Some people think some of it's probably been destroyed just because nothing has resurfaced, which is like the people I've heard talking about that in various media, right? It just, there's like a sorrow in their voice of like, oh, now no one can have it.
Right. So there's a lot of suspects. I'm going to run through them. And they all kind of are just variations on a theme, which is that they are all like mob adjacent.
Sure.
Which is very fun to me because I'm like, oh, it's kind of like The Departed, but for art. So.
Yeah. Putting the art in The Departed.
Yeah. There we go. Oh, my God. Episode title. Boom. We did it.
I really do, though. I've like thought for years that this would make a great, like a fictionalized adaptation of this, right?
Yeah.
It would be so fun. And I don't know that there's been one, or there certainly hasn't been like a definitive one.
What are the Dunkings doing? Let's get them
I
out
know.
Here.
I mean, truly, that would be the cast, right?
It would.
Ben Affleck, get at me.
Yes. So the first guy was Robert Donati, and he hung out with local mobsters kind of in and out of jail. People have implicated him in the heist, but the FBI never formally named him as a suspect. But in September 1991, he was found stabbed, his throat was slashed, and his body was found like only days after the fact in the trunk of his car. So police at the time thought his death had to do with like a power struggle within the New England mafia. But some people speculated he might have been connected to the heist. And that's because in 2011, known thief Miles Connor wrote in his biography that he'd visited the museum with Donati years before the theft. And he also said one of his friends who'd visited him in prison told him that Donati was involved in the heist. According to this friend, David Houghton, the goal was, like you said, to use the artwork as a bargaining chip in order to get Connor released from jail, because at the time he was serving 10 years for drug trafficking. But Houghton died in 1992 of a heart attack. And then there's also the former capo of the New England Mafia, Vincent Ferrara, who said Donati told him in 1990 that he'd robbed the museum and buried the artwork and was going to use it to get him, the capo, out of prison, according to a book written by a former Boston Globe reporter. And I got to say, I feel like burying the artwork doesn't, I feel like that would ruin it.
Yeah, it seems like inelegant storage. Even yes. If you have a really firmly sealed Rubbermaid container, yeah. I just wouldn't trust it.
I'm like, you're the mob. You don't have better storage facilities? Like, yeah. You don't have one guy?
I mean, but I'm also, I get nervous about storage. Like, I don't even feel comfortable bringing edibles on an airplane. You know what I mean? In like my toiletries bag. So I do feel like I would get too anxious. Yes. I also think, I just want to pause for a moment and talk about the idea of trading priceless artworks to get people out of prison for whatever drug trafficking, racketeering.
Yeah.
It wouldn't occur to me that that's a thing you can do.
Right. I feel like the FBI would be like, no, you can go into jail with him. Like,
right.
We're not going to reward bad behavior. I'm like a school teacher now.
Yeah.
They'd be like, that's not how it works.
Right. It's not, like, it's certainly not in the, like, there's no formal channel for doing that.
Yeah.
They're not like, look, this guy, if you know someone that's in jail, but you have priceless art, we will accept the art and then they can have their freedom back.
Be like, well, he's not really worth a Rembrandt, so.
Yeah, that's right.
And also what's interesting is a fine art appraiser from Boston, Paul Calantropo, had said that in the spring of 1990, Donati came to him with this bronze figurine and asked how much it was worth. He recognized it from the heist.
And there's like all these little kind of apocryphal sightings, right? I think at some point, there were reports that two of the paintings were like hanging in someone's home.
Yes, we'll get to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, okay, good.
Yes.
It's so fascinating. Like it's all been so elusive.
Yes. So then there's the Merlino crew, they're local criminals, you know, Boston boys, ties to the mob as it goes.
I just want to say, yes. I've got not a bad word to say about any of these people.
Of course, if they're still alive and listening.
Yeah, or if they've got relatives who are alive, friends, fans.
Yeah.
I got nothing, I'm not a hater.
Oh my God.
I would sooner, look.
I got a jacket that says Merlino crew.
I would sooner offend the Swifties.
Oh my God, brave.
Boston mob affiliate who is also a Swiftie is maybe the scariest person I can imagine.
So true. Yes, no, I mean, no hate. I you know, all of these things are pretty impressive, especially because how rudimentary this heist really was. Mm-hmm. They just did the damn thing with duct tape and like a dream.
Yeah, it's truly like, you think, I always picture like the Catherine Zeta-Jones lasers, right?
Yes.
When you're doing a heist, no. Like from Entrapment. No, yeah, they just came in and they like disabled the cameras. They duct taped the two guards. They tricked them by being like, hey, come over here for a second.
Yeah, pizza delivery.
And it really was a pretty, like, we talk about AI, we talk about technology, right? Making our jobs easier. These guys, it was just elbow grease.
A farm-to-table heist, truly.
That's right.
Okay, so my head kind of hurt trying to make sense of this theory, but I'm going to try to break it down. So we have Carmelo Merlino. First of all, great name. Mm-hmm. Excellent. He was a friend of the mob, and he bragged to two FBI informants that he was going to find the artwork and collect the reward. But he never got the chance because in 1999, the FBI arrested him For trying to rob an armed car depot, and this happened, he was arrested during a sting.
So he did have 9 years to bring this plan to fruition.
Yeah, like, what were you doing, man?
He was either, it was an unsolvable proposition, or he was procrastinating, and let this be a lesson. I said I wasn't going to speak ill of the Boston mob, but I do think it should be a lesson in carpe diem.
Yes. He's like, no, I just got to like move some things around. And it's like, bro, you've been doing that for 8 years.
Yeah, you keep saying it. Yeah, you're going to find the art and get the $10 million reward. You're going to write your novel. Whatever, dude.
So he actually was offered leniency if he was able to actually just cough up the stolen artwork. But he never did and died in prison in 2005. Then there were theories that some of his associates were involved. Their names were George Reisfelder, Leonard DiMuzio, and David Turner. The first two died in 1991. What's interesting is Reisfelder had actually gotten out of prison in 1982 after being convicted of a murder he didn't commit. His relatives later told authorities that they saw a painting hanging over his bed that really looked like one of the Monets that was stolen.
Which that is so baller.
I am obsessed.
If that's how he was living, that's like, I know he died a violent death.
Yes.
Because of, you know, whatever criminal activity he was enmeshed in. But what a way to have lived. To have,
right?
To have like a stolen Rembrandt over your bed.
It's so baller. He actually died of a cocaine overdose, which feels very on brand.
It sounds so suspicious when you go, Robert Donati, right, was murdered a year after, Bob yes. Donati was murdered a year after the heist. And you go, oh, that's suspicious. And then you're like, oh, all these guys are in the mob.
Yeah, so like they can be murdered for any reason. Happen.
Right, right, right. It's a job hazard.
Yes. I'm like, I watch The Sopranos. I know how it goes.
Right. It's not all art related.
Yes, it's
in fact,
not.
Most mob murders, I would venture a guess, are not art related.
Probably not. What's interesting, too, is by the time Reisfelder died, the painting was just gone. Mm-hmm. And then DiMuzio was shot to death in Boston, and also in 91. We don't really know why. Again, it could be any number of mob-related shootings. And Turner got out of prison in 2019 because he was convicted of trying to rob the armored car depot with Merlino. But it doesn't seem as though he was ever really connected. So then we have Robert Guarente, who, I mean, honestly, this list is just really turning into like a who's who of the Boston Mafia.
Mm-hmm. Right, Whitey Bulger's name comes up at some point,
right? I was wondering. I was like, is it going to come up? It didn't mm-hmm. come up in my research, but.
Oh, yeah. It was assumed just because he was so connected. Right. And I think had, yeah. But it. I think there was no real firm connection. It just was like, I think when a crime happened in the 90s in Boston of this scale, you'd go, wow, we should check, see if Whitey Bulger was involved.
So true. So Guarante was a convicted bank robber with ties to the mafia, so I feel that's checking the boxes right now. And the FBI thinks he ended up getting the paintings at some point. That's because he died in 2004, and 6 years after that, his wife told the FBI that before he died, he had given two of the stolen paintings to this other Connecticut mobster, Robert, I don't know if it's Gentile, who knows? Is he Italian?
Try a few more.
Yeah, right?
We know he's not Jewish, yes. If that's what you're saying.
100%. So the FBI searched, let's go with Gentile's home, and found a list of the stolen paintings and their estimated value, and also a newspaper article about the heist from the day after it happened. Although I kind of wonder why you would like save the newspaper article just to be like, that's me, like hanging it up on my billboard.
I think my parents save newspaper clippings of stuff that I've done in my career.
Yes.
So I guess you want for posterity.
So apparently he was about to sell the paintings to an undercover FBI agent for $500,000 each. But after he got arrested, he was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know about any paintings.
Yeah. That's savvy.
Yes.
But you'd think if the idea was we're using this to get people out of jail.
Yep.
If I'm not for myself, who am I? What am I?
The existential or who
will
questions.
Be, excuse me, if I'm not for myself, who will be, right? So if you're not using those paintings to get yourself out of jail, you're leaving money on the table.
Right, they're just sitting there. And he actually did fail a polygraph when asked if he'd ever had one of the paintings or knew about their whereabouts. But we all know polygraphs are just like crystals, basically. Yeah, just going off vibes.
All that stuff is so wild. I'm sure you talk about it all the time on the show, but like all that stuff of like blood spatter science. And it's just like some guy was like, looks like the bullet came from there.
Yeah.
Like, it's not, it's all just like, John Mulaney has a joke about before there was DNA evidence, it would just be some guy going, back to my hunch.
Yes.
Like, that's what it all feels like.
It truly was that. And we will never really know if he was involved because he got out of prison in 2019 and died 2 years later at age 85. Then one of the night guards actually was kind of looked at as a suspect too, the 23-year-old Robert Abeth. He said he wasn't involved in the heist, but investigators always kind of wondered if it was an inside job. And that's because, and I'm quoting from the Boston Globe here just because there is really truly no way to paraphrase this sentence. Motion sensors that recorded the thieves' steps as they moved about the museum indicate that they never entered the first floor gallery where Manet's Chez Tortoni was stolen. But Abath's footsteps were recorded there, and he'd actually briefly opened the side door before he buzzed in the robbers.
Yep. And so, he said, in subsequent interviews, he'd said that he routinely would open the door and then shut it to make sure that the locking mechanism was in place, and which is not protocol. Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
But I'm like, but as an overthinker.
OCD king. but yeah, and there was footage on the security cameras of him letting someone into the museum at one point, briefly talking to him. And he said, I don't remember that. And then other people who had worked at the museum at the time went, oh, that's like the deputy director of security. Like, I know that guy very well. It seemed that that was at least a plausible exoneration of that.
Yeah, that seems fair. It seems like for what they were able to accomplish, they didn't even really need it to be an inside job. All it took was a buzzer, you don't, if it's inside, you don't need to buzz in.
Yes. Yeah. it seemed pretty easy to get inside, right?
Yeah.
It's like an anybody could get inside job.
Definitely. Definitely. So, all right, we're almost done with this suspect list, kind of. Another suspect that came up was Brian McDevitt. I actually love his bio because he's a screenwriter who was also involved in a botched art robbery in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'm just like, I love his LinkedIn for him.
You'd think you'd leave that off the resume, right?
Or
just like, what were you doing for 6 months? And he's like, not a botched art robbery, that's for sure.
I love that. Or like, I think you have to make it your brand. And you're like, I only write botched robbery movies.
Yeah, that's right. And then people would just go, oh, that's professional development.
Yes, exactly. And this was actually 10 years before the Gardner heist. And it was pretty similar to what went down because 10 years before he had this accomplice. I actually don't think it was that similar, but similar in the sense that they hijacked a FedEx truck and literally ethered the driver. Like, wow. They knocked him out with ether. And I was like, I did not know that that was a thing people did. I thought only rappers talked about it metaphorically. Mm-hmm.
No, that's where they get the metaphor from. That's art imitates life.
Truly. So then they put on these FedEx uniforms and they go to the Hyde Collection in Glen Falls, New York. I'm like, hey, our two hometowns are kind of like colliding in this app. So they had duct tape and some tools. But this is actually the funniest thing that I've ever heard because I don't really understand why they couldn't still pull off the heist, but they got stuck in traffic and they didn't get to the museum until after it had closed. So what does that mean? Like, there's no security guards to buzz them in? Like, why can't you just, you're going to steal artwork. You won't break a window. Like, right. What's going on?
Yeah, that is, they feel too, again, we're talking about procrastination. We're talking about letting the little things get in the way of our goals, right? And I think, like, if you really want it, if you have that art thief dog in you, then you're going to go in even after the museum's closed.
Come on. You gave up so easily. And then the truck driver ended up IDing them. And so he spent a couple months in jail for attempted robbery. And he was actually living in Beacon Hill at the time of the Gardner Museum heist.
Okay, fancy.
Yes, fancy. And he was interviewed by the FBI a couple times, even put before a grand jury, but nothing really came of it. He always maintained he knew nothing. And then he passed away in 2004 at age 43. Every time I read these ages, I'm like, yeah, I forget that this heist was not long ago. And these people are like presumably still alive.
Yeah, some of them, I think, you know, some of them, it's or long enough ago
died.
That And these are people that were not living wellness-infused lives.
No,
right?
Definitely not.
So a lot of them are dead, presumably. But like, yeah, it was 34 years ago. So if they were, people in their 20s were doing this, they could be living, approaching retirement now.
Yeah, that's
great. Assuming they didn't benefit from the $500 million of stolen art.
Right,
they
could already be retired. Mm-hmm. So then we have William Youngworth Jr., who was an antiques dealer in Brighton, Massachusetts. He'd said he had access to the stolen paintings in 97, and he ended up showing a Boston Herald reporter what he said was Rembrandt's Storm on the Sea of Galilee.
All coverage of this heist brings up Storm on the Sea of Galilee as Rembrandt's only seascape. And
is that not true?
No, I think it is. Oh. But I also don't know why that matters. I'm not like, God, I just wish he did more fucking seascapes, dude. Just look at those waves.
I know. I got to look at this seascape to really get a picture.
Yeah. He's always painting land like an asshole.
So I guess it did convince the reporter because there was a story on the front page with the headline, "We've seen it?" Question mark. I'm like, what?
But that's that rule. You went to school for journalism. Yes. You know, when they put the question in the headline, the answer is no, right?
Yeah, they're like, we're legally not able to say definitively that we've seen it.
Are your kids addicted to snorting ground up horse hooves? No, they're not. That's why you phrased it like a question.
Yes. So then he kind of took a page out of the mobster's playbook. He started trying to negotiate with the feds. I actually fucking respect this guy. He had a lot of balls. So he he wanted a $5 million reward, immunity from prosecution. He also wanted state charges that were pending against him at the time dismissed. And he wanted his friend Miles Connor, who we already talked about, who mm-hmm. was that kind of career criminal. He wanted him released from prison because he was serving time for drug charges. And I'm like, all right, man, shoot for the moon.
Yeah. If you, they don't know what you want if you don't ask for it.
Yeah. Worst they can say is no. And also you're going to jail.
That's right. Lean in.
Yeah. I actually think this is so funny because the deal fell apart in 1997, not because the FBI was like, no.
Yeah.
But because apparently they tested some paint fragments that Youngworth had provided and it didn't match Rembrandt. Mm. But another test done years later found that they actually were consistent with Vermeer, who was another 17th century mm-hmm. painter. And so he might have had it all along.
They had a Vermeer.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's and Vermeer, I believe only there are only like 34 known paintings or something like the 30s or 40s known paintings made by Vermeer. So this is like a pretty rare thing. But this guy was just like, here's Rembrandt. And they were like, nope. And they weren't like, could this be Vermeer? And
yeah.
Like, I don't fucking know, man. They're buried in my backyard. I didn't like keep track. I couldn't Google it before it came here. It was 1997.
They didn't have that app where you just like, they didn't have Google Lens. They're not.
They didn't Google anything.
Yeah, true.
Amazon was just a bookstore.
Oh my God.
I think this is, was this pre-Amazon 97? When was Amazon founded? Yeah.
But I do love that the FBI was like, all right, we'll give you your $5 million, absolutely zero consequences. We'll throw your friend out of jail. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't match Rembrandt. So sorry, dude.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you don't want to get.
That's where they draw the line.
You don't want to get got with a fake Rembrandt. He gives you, you're like, dude, you took this off your refrigerator. There's magnet marks on it.
Is this
isn't
crayon?
Rembrandt.
Yeah.
It's Crayon, a little known French artist.
Obsessed.
From the Crayola school. Yeah.
Obsessed. So decades later, there might have been a clue. So in March 2022, the Boston chief of police said that they had gotten a tip about the death of a criminal that happened in 1990. So Jimmy Marks was a career criminal who was shot and killed outside of his apartment in Lynn, Massachusetts. And the killer had unscrewed the light bulb over the door ahead of the time, so he like kind of wouldn't see it coming. Mm-hmm. And this is apparently, according to people who would know, a classic mob-style hit. And he was also shot twice in the back of the head, mm-hmm. which feels like execution style. I don't know. And according to a new tip, days before he had died, Marks was bragging about having two of the stolen paintings from the heist. And he had also been connected to two of the suspects who we talked about earlier, Robert Guarente and Bobby Donati, who this is really sounding like a Sopranos episode.
It is. I mean,
I love it. But so, and these are two of the guys who might have helped mm-hmm. him route the paintings to Philly by way of Connecticut, which is kind of the prevailing theory.
You have to go through Connecticut. That's the thing. Anyone who's driven from Boston to New York or Philly knows that you have to go by way of Connecticut.
Yes, the only way to go. And Marks had spent time in prison for a bank robbery. He'd also told his niece before the robbery that he had something big coming up, but wasn't sure if he was going to do it. She thought he was talking about like a cocaine deal at the time, mm-hmm. but now it might have actually been the heist that he was referring to.
Again, I'm breaking my rule once more about not disparaging the mob, because I do think bragging to your niece is not cool.
Yeah, you're of all people. I'm like, you have a whole crew of people who have like a blood oath of silence.
Yeah, you're Talk trying to convince them. Like a 14-year-old that your career's going well.
Yeah.
And I will say, as a comedian, I do relate to a lot of these people because, like them, I imagine the lifestyle imposed by my career will eventually kill me.
Yes, the cortisol. What's also interesting, too, was Bobby Guarante's widow said that Bobby had killed Jimmy, like, after Bobby's death. She was shown a picture of Jimmy and was like, oh, yeah, Bobby killed that guy. So
not knowing the guy's name, but, like, knowing by sight, like, oh, yeah, that's one of the guys my husband killed. That is, he must be killing so many guys that she's like, I don't know all his work friends.
I feel like I wouldn't want to know.
No, like, absolutely don't want to know. You got to keep your head in the sand.
Yeah. Plausible deniability. What have we learned from mob movies?
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty much it. I mean, it does seem like it's, I don't think if we find out it's going to be some like random person, it's going to be someone with connections to the mob.
Yeah. Right. Again, it's not like it's going to be some gentleman thief that nobody's ever heard of.
I watched that show White Collar where he was like...
Oh, I don't know that show.
Oh, it's so good. It was on USA when USA was like the golden age of television. Mm-hmm. But it was about this like...
The monk years.
Yes, the monk years. It was like this very hot guy who would like forge art paintings so well. So like, it's not going to be him.
Ooh, I love an art... There's a great art forgery doc, too.
Ooh.
I gotta find the name of it because it's so good. It's about how this guy in New York, took all these gallerists for all this money, but forging art. And they all, like, kind of the thesis of it is, like, they should have known better, but, like, it was too good to be true. So they all kind of got taken in by this forger
Ooh.
And a dealer that was, like, kind of the charismatic face of the operation.
Okay, but I do feel as though if you're able to provide a convincing forgery, you have talent.
I think that's right. I think it should be worth at least half as much.
It should be worth something.
And if you're going to convince like a rich person to spend like $6 million on a painting, that's on them.
Yeah, agree.
No matter what it looks like. Right? Like I don't mean that from the like, oh, I could make that school of modern art. I just mean you're on base. Like once they give you the money for the art forgery, you should have immunity because they got.
I feel
fair
like,
and square.
Yes. I feel like so much art is just like buying stuff for the label. Like, you know, like the Birkin bag or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's just like, if you think that this thing looks like, if it looks exactly the same and the only difference is it has this guy's signature,
Right. If it falls apart like a Canal Street purse after like 3 weeks, then maybe you go back and complain.
But, yes.
But if it's hanging in your house and you don't find out till there's a documentary that wants to interview you, that's on you, dude. That
would be the worst. You got busted.
Yeah. Just documentary crew being like, we're here about art forgeries. And you're like, ah, shit. Son of a, I could have had a house with that money.
Oh, man. That would be amazing. Well, this was so fun.
Sarah, this was truly a delight. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Where can people follow you, tune into your special, plug all the things?
I'm at Josh Gondelman across social media, GONDELMAN. My special is, I think it's on like YouTube and Tubi and Vimeo, all the places to watch things. It's called People Pleaser. My newsletter is joshgondelman.substack.com. It's called That's Marvelous. It's full of pep talks for readers and people in the news and stuff. I have a book, if you can find it, called Nice Try, Stories of Best Intentions and Mixed Results. And I'm on the road doing a ton of stand-up. I think like is for sure. I'm going, I've got a ton of dates coming up. I'm going to St. Paul very soon and then Bloomington, Indiana and New Orleans and San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, Burlington, Vermont, and joshgondelman.com for all the tour dates and stuff.
Amazing. Thank you so much, guys. Check Josh out and thank you for listening. Follow us on Instagram at Not Another True Crime. write your theories in the Facebook group. I don't know what your theories would be, guys, but if you want to, it's there. Not Another True Crime group. You can follow me on Instagram at Sarah Lamim. Always follow Danny as well, Cashmere Danny with a K, and we'll be right back here next week.
Not Another True Crime podcast is produced by Jorge Morales Pico, Sean Kilby, and Rebecca Sosmacat. Editing by Jorge Morales Pico. Social media by Sarah Levine. Be sure to follow at Not Another True Crime on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and send all of your emails to natc@betches.com.
Betches.